Hey, everybody. This is Sober Life Radio, and I'm Joel Yeager with the beautiful and talented Carrie Loeffler.
Aw, thanks, Joel.
And that was Greg Lake, who died last week. That was pretty sad. He was one of the founding members of Emerson, Lake & Palmer and King Crimson. And that song I was telling Carrie, that's actually an anti, it's played all Christmas long, and it's actually an anti-Christmas song. And it, what they did was they actually were making, they're critical of people who just have a life all year of being mean and all this suffering and everything. But Christmas time, you know, everybody's like happy and, you know, praising.
Generous.
Yeah, they're generous. They're, you know, they have Santa Claus. They have all this kind of stuff. But in a world, there's people that are still suffering that day.
Right.
So when they wrote it, it was really, it's an anti-Christmas song, but it's just interesting because when you're in the malls and everything, they're playing this one, it was, everyone's singing and dancing when he was actually criticizing you guys that are singing and dancing, you know.
I feel like there's a lot of, well, even the song that we normally play for our intro is like that. People hear it as like an upbeat, happy song, but it's about something else because people don't listen to the message usually.
Right. That's what it is. They like the beat.
Yeah.
And that's what music does.
Mm-hmm.
Look at, oh my God, George Harrison's, can't even think. What's the name of the song now? Where he's like the Harry Christmas song, right? So everybody's like, and kids were playing it.
Uh-huh.
These Christian kids, one day were playing it in a church, singing and dancing, like, you know.
Oh,
but it was song. Yeah, he did this on purpose because music. People just listen to the music and forget the meanings.
Well, there's two types of people because you have the people that just listen to the beat, and then you have the people that analyze the lyrics.
Yeah,
I'm a little bit of both. I love the beat and the lyrics.
Yeah, I listen to the song first, and then I might listen to the. You know,
my dad taught me that, though, growing up, like, listen to the lyrics.
Yeah.
And I believe the first song he made me do that with was Mother's Little Helper.
Yeah.
By Rolling Stones, which is interesting looking back on it. I'm like,
no,
okay.
You're right. But isn't that
like,
funny?
What are you getting at here, Dad?
Right. But it's, yeah, and it's so funny because, or you could be Bob Dylan, who really just writes songs that rhyme, and people spent years and years and years studying Bob Dylan songs, and he would laugh saying, well, no. We have a Bob Dylan song today coming into our guest, but. Yeah, because his songs really meant nothing. And he just wanted, because, you know, they say, Bob, what did that mean? He goes, same, it rhymed with damn.
Like most of the rap songs out there today.
That's all it was, and it means nothing. It is good rhyming. But yeah, so last week we had a great, what a show, right?
Yeah, it was, we pulled it off, I think.
Yeah, we pulled it off big.
Yeah.
And Casa Trinity, if you're listening, they did that's a crew out there. They didn't even deny it. We came out and talked to them, and they just provided us, you know, the support and the underwriting.
Yeah, which is huge because I said it on our Facebook page, but they're not even from this county.
No,
and they helped us out. They helped make this happen, and that's unheard of.
Yeah,
unheard of. So thank you guys.
Yeah, and I think it's like, everything they're doing, they actually have another open house for an Oswego clinic. You know, they're doing, and Domingo's down there. She's so ahead of the game on all this stuff. And it's interesting because she's even into Pennsylvania now. But if you ever listen to her talk, she'll tell you where all this is going. And it's funny because her strategies and where she's putting treatment centers down there in these rural areas and trying to, because people, it's not a city. I mean, heroin is not a city problem. I mean, that's everywhere now. And it's coming into those rural farming districts.
Right.
And before, when I first came into business, there was never a center that you could send anybody to that they didn't have to travel to.
Right.
You know, if I think back, I mean, it was very few, and she has just expanded through all these areas. So we want to thank her.
Yeah. A lot of people came out to help support us. We had Rockcovery Fitness out there.
Yes.
They were selling their Faces of Rockcovery calendar, which is great. I already have mine up in the office. Each month has a different picture and a different story from somebody in the Rochester recovery community. So
we have to get in that calendar. Like next year, we have to get something. Like then we get to whatever.
This was pre our relationship with them.
Yeah,
but it's a really cool thing. And Luke Laporta, photography.
Yes.
He's the one that took all the pictures. He was also there for the show last week, as was Christopher Copeland. So Chris and Luke, if you're listening, thank you for taking pictures.
Yeah, great photographers.
Yep. Becky Baker was out.
Yep.
Representing the Overdose Awareness Day.
The wonderful Becky Baker.
She's fantastic.
And we're going to get her involved in the summer, I think.
Yeah, we're going to.
We have to really talk about this, because when I tell people we're going to do a festival, I say, what do you mean? Oh my God, you better start dealing with the city now.
Because well, we got a couple things up our sleeve, a couple tricks up our sleeve that we're not going to talk about yet. But just stay tuned, because I talked to an exciting person the other day that hopefully we can
like real exciting. Get here.
I'm really excited. I don't want to say anything on the air, but
yeah, we better not.
We might be bringing somebody pretty awesome to Rochester for the upcoming festival in the summertime. Let's see, and obviously we had Dave from Rochester Free Radio.
Yes, Dave was there.
Thank you, Dave.
Dave did a great job.
I know a lot of it wasn't really his cup of tea. I saw something posted there. About can't wait to listen to some Coltrane when he gets home.
Really? Well, next time we're going to have Coltrane, Dave. Just
once
wait.
Once the rapping and the loud music got started.
And you're Tracy.
Yes, Tracy, if you're listening, which you were, thank you so much for being our door person.
Yes.
She sat there by a freezing cold door
right.
for the entire night.
Yes.
So.
Coffee Connection
was
there. They were there, and Tracy knows that pitch by heart right now. I bet she has memorized the Coffee Connection
pitch.
I'd like
a cup of coffee. Have you heard about our mission?
Right.
Which is great, because, you know, they tell everybody.
Well, they have, right. It's a great story, and so if you really want to know, we'll give you Tracy's number, and Tracy can go ahead and tell you, because she's. I mean, just looking at her face, oh my God, here he goes for the 100th time. But it was good.
Yeah.
Thanks, Tracy.
No, it was great. It was really helpful. And I felt bad for her because there was a sign that the pillar didn't want people smoking right out front.
Right.
And so, of course, Tracy has to be the person that's like, and the venue doesn't want people smoking. So if you could just step to the left. And of course, nobody listens.
Right. Because she has that, you know, little.
A for effort. Thanks.
Yeah. She has that little Dave Matthews voice.
Yeah. And the pillar. We can't not thank them. So thank you.
Yes.
Thank you, Brian, for being our sound guy.
Oh, that was wonderful. And hope the Christmas tree survived.
You should have seen Joel and I trying to set that place up.
That was funny. It was actually funny because Carrie should never grab a Christmas tree. We just learned that.
I just picked it from the center and lifted, and I still have an injury.
Yeah.
So
that was great. And Jeff's feedback.
Yeah.
That was huge. And I got to tell you, because I thought, well, and I don't want ruin our great night by saying it must have been a slow news night. But when they send a music editor from the DNC to cover your event, you're already jacked up, right? When you walked in the door, said, holy cow, this is big. But the article is fantastic.
It was great.
Other than Carrie just recognized one little thing.
Yeah, Joel said, continuously tells people the story of us meeting and how he heard me talk, and he's like, this chick's out of her mind. She's crazy. She's insane. I gotta get her on.
Yeah, she'd be a great co-host.
So, yeah, of course he had to say that.
And as a woman, she only could read, you know, a two-page article. She only picked out that little bitty line where I said, because he asked me, how'd you guys meet? And then I said, and that was true, though. I mean, I just remember just
staring. And instead of being like, yeah, I met her at work, and she was this fantastic, wonderful, you know, outgoing individual. He's like, yeah, she's out of her mind.
She was out of her
freaking
mind.
Crazy.
No, and I was just so, like, intrigued by her that I was so afraid of her, too. I didn't even want to approach her the first time.
So that's what you should have said, intrigued. It's Wait. Better than out of her mind.
Well, now we're doing it on the radio. But so, you were out of your mind. You were just off the wall.
Yeah. But no, so thank you to everybody. I know if you're listening, you had to sit through our list of thank yous, but it's important for us to acknowledge everybody that made that possible, including everyone that performed. Meg Gaiman,
right.
Jason Ferguson, Blindside Justice, Dead Fountain, which we had our first proposal.
Right. And you knew about it. I didn't know he was
going to
do it. I
did know about it. And I don't even normally like stuff like that. Like, I'm the one that's like, ugh.
Right.
Ugh. And I got all choked up.
Yeah, I wasn't even sure. I was waiting for her to say no. Or something, but
those guys
she
are
did.
Great. And then Twitch, obviously.
Yeah.
And man, the crowd really responded well to him.
Yeah. Well, you would. I mean, that's at the high end of the game right there.
Yeah.
You can tell when they come in, they're very smooth. And
yeah.
But no, so, and then Friday, I might as well give them a promotion. So this on Friday night, the 23rd, he's playing again in Buffalo.
Yeah, at the Intune Festival. I've shared it on our page. I've shared it on my personal page. It's really interesting. They have some workshops starting at 5, so we'll make sure to get there for that.
Right.
One of them that I just noticed after I was sharing it was something about addiction treatment with psychedelics.
Really?
So it should be interesting.
I bet they do well.
Everyone's at that booth.
But they just come in. I mean, wow, it's hard. Yeah, we don't give them gum.
Yeah.
So they just come in and, wow, that's terrific.
So it'll be interesting. You'll learn some things. And there's several performers. Twitch is going on later that evening. But we're going to go show them our support. And I think the last, we should thank everybody that came out to the show.
Oh, sure.
We got a pretty decent turnout.
Yeah, and I think the response, I mean, everyone, even on their way out, was hoping that we would do it sooner than later.
Yeah. Somebody was like, you should do this monthly.
Yeah, these
events.
I don't
think people realize it actually.
The work
involved.
There's cost and work. And, But we are looking at something soon, so yeah. we'll get back out there. Yeah. It's interesting. So the federal government this week is giving billions of dollars. This is how you know you made it or didn't make it in the disease part of the world, is that there are only two causes they're actually focusing on this year. One was cancer, mm-hmm. obviously, because it's crazy. We had Greg Lake, and he died of a long battle with cancer. But and now it's going to be opiate treatment and addiction.
There you go.
It's funny that we have actually reached now the level of cancer in this country, because it's so scary. People still don't know how to treat it and what to do for it.
Well, there was a news release. There were more overdose deaths than death by gunshot.
Right.
Recently.
Yeah, and everyone's just confused about it.
Yeah.
You know who I want to get on?
Who?
And if she's listening, is Lovely Warren. Because Lovely Warren made a news conference that she is going to.
Good luck with that.
Yeah. Or getting her on, or just well, let me tell you something, Lovely. If you can listen, or if you know somebody out, if any of you are listening and you actually know her, I want it, please. I got to get her in, because I want it. She came out and she's going to take over the opiate. This is good. It's good for a mayor. Mm-hmm. She's going to fix the opiate problem in Rochester.
Oh, yep. Single-handedly.
Yep. And she's going to open up treatment centers, and she's going to do all this stuff that I can't even get 5 extra beds from the state in a facility that's already there, because the red tape.
An OASIS license, and regulated, and funding.
Right.
Okay.
And a program in an area that we are just completely saturated with an opiate problem. And I can't even get 5 extra beds.
I'd
and
be she's, really interested to hear,
she
too.
She is going to open up centers everywhere, and I have to get her in because I just want to know. This is the thing. I hope you talk to somebody ahead of time, and maybe, because I have to talk to the state. Oh, and she's running for re-election.
Isn't that, I'm sure there's no coincidence in that timing.
No, but we really, really have to get her in, because I want to see how you're doing it. Like, how you going to do it?
Yeah.
No one else. You can't even get an additional halfway house in here. And she's going to open.
I told you, I got an email the other day asking if I would be interested in joining her opiate task force.
Yeah.
More details will be revealed, so I don't have that much information on it. But I'm like, oh, sure. Sign me up, because this will be interesting.
Yeah, please. And then, the state, who regulates all the drug and alcohol, monies, and also regulates the treatment centers, please, tell me how she's going to be able to do that.
And if she can, fantastic.
That is fantastic. But then you need to then help everybody else who's been all these years trying to get new programs in here, because there is not enough programming at all in the state of New York for the heroin epidemic. There's not. And so, Lovely Warren, if you're able to do that, terrific. How are you going to do it? Please come on in, because I really want to know.
Yeah,
I'm so interested.
I'd love to know.
Yeah. I read the article. Are you kidding me? Holy cow.
And crack down on Clinton Avenue.
Right.
What about every other place?
Right.
Get the most obvious place.
Right.
Again, I'm sure, it's nothing to do with the re-election coming up.
No, Clinton Avenue, we talked about that the other day. We know when your street only has an initial, they forgot about you. So,
FD.
Right. So if you're like in the A to Z category, a lot of the problem is,
Well, and things have changed so much when it comes to that anyways, because yes, that's like a hot spot for heroin. You go to this area of the city, you can get heroin. But things changed. Back in my day, you had to drive up and down a street. Hopefully you saw someone that you recognize, flag them down, maybe go to a payphone, whatever.
Yeah.
Now it's all through cell phones, and you text your dealer, whatever. It's not like you're just cracking down on one area of the city and it's going to significantly impact
sales. Change it all. Head out to Penfield next, and Pittsford, and every place else that's having a heroin addiction too.
Lovely. I'm going to have to keep my mouth shut on that one.
Right. But I'm just saying,
we would love for her to come on.
I would. If we could work that out, Dave, can you work that out? Dave said, I don't think she... Well, there's somebody... wait a sec. We have the other show during the week. I mean, they know somebody, right?
We'll talk more about this, because there's some information that I have, but I want to talk to some of the people that have that information before I go saying anything on the air, because there's more discussions to have around this. So
good, good.
We'll keep it at that.
We will make sure we promote that if we can get her up here.
Absolutely.
I'm sure she's been to this part of the city, right? I'm sure. She's probably drove by this building, right? We don't know. Okay.
Well, so, well, speaking of guests, we should probably talk a little bit about who our upcoming guest after our music break.
We do have a great guest, right?
Yeah. We have Robert Veeder.
Robert Veeder.
Yes.
Who has a very compelling story, and it's and we know the story, so I'm interested. We talked about this before.
Yeah.
So we're going to get him on. And what else? I don't know what else. But yeah, we're going to be the most controversial radio show going, which is good because this is how it starts. You know, start with a little pee and end up with a plant. So we'll be back. All right, we're back. I had to wait for that part of the lyrics because that's my favorite part is, you know, when he felt uneasy when she tied the lights of my shoes.
We should probably talk. So I realized that when we listen to the podcast, obviously, if it's not original music being played live in the studio, we can't play it in the podcast. So right. People that are listening are like, what are they talking about? So what song was that that just played?
That was Tangled Up in Blue of Bob Dylan. And it's one of my favorite Dylan tunes. But just that whole line, because remember that time we're sitting in the office and we're talking about how, you know, how do you determine if you could be really creepy? And we're sitting there, and we're sitting there with this other guy that we know named Art. And Art just sit there, and I said, man, if I could get creepy down to a science, he goes, man.
That's right, I remember that.
And he goes, and he just looks at Carrie, he goes, could I have one of your shoes? And she almost gave it to him and was like, now that's creepy.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So every time I hear that song, I think of you and Art, and you handing Art over one of your slippers or whatever it was. But we have Robert Veeder here in the audience. This is a great in the audience.
In the audience.
In the audience. We pulled him down. It's a really fascinating story. And I think, you know, we talked before, we met him a couple times. And it's interesting because you can look at it from so many different ways. Mm-hmm. And especially when you have the person here, you want to ask him all those, you know, all that terrible stuff. But. Yeah. And we will, because that's what we do. But it's just really, you know, so I think this is a very interesting time of year with a lot of things going on and holidays and stuff. But
yeah,
it's a hard story.
Yeah,
it is a hard story.
Not a happy story.
No. So. And for those that are listening, Robert's story, and we'll let him kind of tell it from start to finish, you know, the whole classic, what was it like, what happened, and what's life like now. But you know, Robert was involved in a drunk driving accident that cost six people their lives.
Right.
And, it's a heavy story.
It is
but
a heavy story.
There's a lot of redemption in it, a lot of hope. And Robert is an amazing guy. And I'm not just saying that. I met Robert through the show, and just what an incredible guy. So
yeah, we're glad to get you on today.
So, you know, we'll just have you start talking. Just tell us a little bit about, just tell
sort
us whatever you want.
Qualify myself, yeah.
Yeah,
I mean, that's the traditional way of saying it. So, my name's Robert. I'm 45 years old now. When this accident happened, I think I was trying to think this morning. I couldn't, it's sort of sad, but I can't remember if I was 31 or 32. Mm-hmm. I was somewhere in between those ages, and I don't think I was paying much attention to my age at that time. Mm-hmm. I learned that I'm a, classically termed in clinical terms, I'm a polysubstance addict. I didn't know that. I always thought my drug of choice was alcohol, but I was incarcerated for a long time, and I was in a sociology class when I was incarcerated, and the sociology teacher started listing, we were talking about urban development, things like this, and he started listing different substances on the board, and I started looking at him, and there were a lot of substances on the board, and all of a sudden I realized, I took everything there,
right. Yeah.
And I started realizing that, you know, I my drug of choice was just more. So
yeah,
I started off pretty early, and I never really had an off switch. You know, I really started having problems around 14 years old.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I think that's sort of classic for many of us. Mm-hmm. I think most of us started as teens, and I'm not sure why. I don't know if that's genetic or sociological or what, but it was apparent to everybody knew I had a problem. So I went to a residential military school, military academy, which was, you know, almost like a youth spread.
Yeah.
You know,
right.
when I was a teenager, and I graduated when I was 17, and had moved to London, England at that time. And my choice for London, England was because I had heard that you could drink there at 17. So that should have been like a clue. That
right.
Yeah. Right. When I'm making decisions at 17 about,
like,
well,
I'm going to move to a whole different country just so I can drink sooner legally.
This is going to be important in my life. You know, I wanted to move to Jamaica. My parents were like, why don't you go to, you know, England? And I ended up homeless in England for a little while and sleeping in Paddington Station. And
get out of here.
Yeah.
See, this I did not know. So this is new to me.
I actually don't go into this a whole lot. But because it was sort of romantic. I was working at a bar for a while, at a pub, in the Dickens Tavern, you know. I slept in a flower box on the second story for a while because I had gotten kicked out of the train station so much, and I wanted to be able to sleep at night. And I found this, I could scale up the side of this building and sleep in this flower box, and it was soft and warm, and the police couldn't find me. Yeah, so that was how I got scabies.
Well, yeah.
We should have given and Robert fear. An hour.
Yeah, so you know, it was a problem from early on. I moved back to the States and ended up in legal trouble then, you know. I think I was like 18 or 19. Ended up going to a residential treatment center at 19, and that was the first time I got sober, you know. And I was going to a lot of mutual support meetings. Mm-hmm. And not working any kind of program, but I was going to like 3 meetings a day. So I thought that was my program.
Right.
So now I meet people that are doing that, and I'm like, oh, don't do that. Get a life, you know.
Yeah.
You know. You know, it became such a war all the time of like, I got to stay sober. I got to stay sober. And I just got tired of it. I was going to meetings all the time. I was hanging out with people in recovery all the time, playing cards. You know, going to coffee shops afterwards, and all we talked about was use and abuse, and
right.
I just got old and tired, and I was a kid, you know, and I was like, maybe it wasn't really that big of a deal. I was young, you know. And so I actually called my sponsor at the time and said, you know, I'm going to go back out, and that was that.
Called him like, you know what,
I'm going to
terminate this relationship.
We're done here.
I fortunately got his answering machine, which made it much easier. You know,
right.
He didn't call me back, so he was a great sponsor. You know, so things progressively got worse, which they do. There's nothing secretive about that. I met a woman, and we had moved in together, and we lived in across from – this is great. We were living in North Carolina in this little tiny house across from a shopping center that was colloquially termed Murder Mart.
Really?
Wow. It was the hood, you know. So.
Oh, my gosh.
Right.
And we loved it. I mean, I loved that place because it was sort of, I don't know, it's just, there was a lot of soul there. And it was romantic. I'm a romantic. And so it was, you know, crack was really just making the rounds and just showing up. Let's see. I did a lot of different jobs. I worked for a design company as a carpenter, and I eventually opened my own chimney sweep business. And by that time, I was mostly smoking pot every day and drinking all night, you know, and I thought that was manageable, you know. Mm-hmm. And I'd reached a point, this is another, should have been like another clue. I reached a point where whenever somebody would offer me a new substance, I would be like, nah, I don't think so. And the reason I wouldn't was I knew what would happen. I knew I'd get addicted to it. So I just couldn't take on any more addictions. It was just too hard to maintain. And so I was not doing well in my business. I could have, I had the opportunity, but I just, you know, the phone would ring and people would ask for work and I just wouldn't show up. And so it was, you know, it was really getting bad. And my partner at the time, we had been together about 9 years, and one night she had just had it. She never really explained why. I don't think we ever really got closure on that, but we had an argument and she walked out. And I went insane, you know. Yeah. I mean, it was the only. So I had, it was like winter. It was December 19th was when that happened. And so I got to spend another Christmas alone. I've done a few of those.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I had turned all the furniture in the house upside down, the TV on its side. I mean, just,
wow.
It was like.
Okay.
And was living like, this is absolutely normal. I decided I could live off of only cheese and tomato sandwiches because that's all the nutrients I needed, and I couldn't keep any food down anyway anymore, and was just drinking all the time. And so I gave one last effort at pulling my life back together, and I went to spend some time with my parents in Alabama and did everything but sober up. I would sort of pull things back together, and I moved back to North Carolina and got a job working for this tile company.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is... getting to the crux of it, I guess.
Yeah.
It was, one night, it was November 1st, 2003, which was it was the day after Halloween, and I spent the whole day in bars. You know, I woke up and I actually went to my regular bar and I was like, I'm not going to drink hard today. I was hungover the night before. It was Halloween. It was a crazy night, and so like 11 in the morning, and so I go to my regular bar and I do what we do, right? I'm like, I'm not today. I'm just going to take it easy. And I asked the bar, I said, look, I just need a cup of coffee. And it was, you know, he said, oh, you know, we're all out of coffee. You know, and so I tried, so I gave it a good effort. And then I was like, well, I got to do something about this hangover, so give me a beer. I drank pretty much all day, a few mixed drinks here. I did what we do. I went to different bars so people didn't know how much I was drinking. And I really didn't think I was that intoxicated. I mean, I wasn't like staggering. Mm-hmm. I was driving around. I wasn't weaving or anything like that. And I bumped into this guy and we were hanging out together. And so this guy I had known sort of peripherally through another friend, and he was like, and I had been to strip joints before, mm-hmm. you know, but I never wanted people to know that I would go to strip joints. I'm not that kind of guy.
Right.
But somebody said, like, hey, if you go to a strip joint, this is the guy that knows how to have a good time there. So I was like, hey, we got to go to a strip joint because I was told you're the kind of guy that knows how to. So he's like, yeah, come on, you know. So we go to the strip club, and I'm beat. It's like 8 o'clock at night. I'm not having a good time, you know. He is, and so I leave, and I was like 3 miles from home.
Oh, jeez.
Yeah, so this is that number is always really important to me because I'm a long distance runner now, and I think 3 miles. You know, I wouldn't even put on my tennis shoes now to run 3 miles.
Yeah.
And I didn't know it, but a football game had let out previously, and some people were coming home on this highway, and car had run a stop sign on this highway and hit another car, T-boned into it. And so a bunch of people saw this accident and they sort of stopped to help, which is what good people do, you know. Mm-hmm. And some kids saw it, I guess, and I actually don't know the whole story of what happened there. So, some people pulled this guy out of a car, they had laid him in the road, 911 had been called, they had a new communication thing and that wasn't working properly, and so a bunch of people sort of had surrounded this guy, and I was driving home in a weighted down with tile and sheetrock and everything else, Econoline work van, you know. Mm-hmm. And so I came over a hill, and there were just a bunch of people in the middle of the road.
Yeah. Know?
So I didn't quite know what happened. I remember trying to like weave the car and slam the brakes, and I remember seeing like the light came on for I don't know, the braking system.
Right.
Now. Right.
And that was the last thing I knew. I mean, I was thrown out of my seat because why wear a seatbelt, you know?
Right.
And, and the airbags went off and I smelled gun smoke and the radio was weirdly playing some music. And I got out of the car and it was just awful.
Yeah. You know?
Mm-hmm.
You obviously immediately realized what had happened, or
mm-hmm. not exactly. It was such a weird, like, I didn't have any ground to sort of put, like, there was no experience like this in my life to be able to relate it to. So there were just people lying everywhere and people screaming, and there was like a fireman running across the road, and I started looking around and I just didn't know what to do. And so I saw a guy and he was just in just terrible pain.
Yeah.
So I ran over to him to try to help, but I didn't know what to do, and I was also a little I was intoxicated, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so he's screaming and I'm just trying to clear, like, I thought maybe he's as confused as I am. So I said, "You've just been in an accident." And at some point I started screaming, "Oh my God, I've killed these people," you know.
Right.
And I went over to the side of the road and I grabbed my knees and I started rocking back and forth. So the police finally showed up and somehow they came to me and they said, "Did you do this?" And I think I said I did or something. I don't exactly mm-hmm. remember. So they, you know, took me, they were like, "Well, we need a breathalyzer." And so this is another thing, you hear in bars all the time is we don't take breathalyzers. You should never take a breathalyzer.
Right.
It's not true at all. But, so they go, "Well, no problem. Just get in the car." And they drove me downtown and they said, "We have a warrant here for your blood. And, you can wrestle us for it or we can strap you down or you can just give it." And I told them, I mean, I'm not trying to wrestle you. I just was told not to take a breathalyzer.
Right. Yeah.
Right.
somewhere in there, walking past a TV, I heard a news thing saying 6 people had been killed, 9 people had been hit, and by an alleged drunk driver. And I thought, well, I couldn't have done all that. I couldn't have hit 6 people. There's no, so they must be confused about everything. And I just didn't. At some point, I will say my mind kind of broke, and I became sort of unable to talk. I started getting a bunch of involuntary twitches and shakes, and so they put me on suicide watch. They give you like a suit made out of paper and put you in an aquarium sort of jail cell. And I don't know how long I was there. They finally, I sat and they put me in general population eventually, and then there people started going, oh, that's the alcoholic, you know, and I remember thinking, no, they don't know, I'm not, right. You know, they're yeah. not, you know, and like they were saying my shakes were from the alcoholism, but I knew that my shakes were from this accident.
Yeah.
I spent 8 months in the county jail. I think I pled no contest, which I still don't quite understand the legal. It was just like saying guilty, but
right without saying it. Yeah, right.
Yeah. I don't know what it was. Honestly, I don't understand the legality.
Right.
Of
yeah, they kind of just tell you what to say, and you just have to trust in your attorney or whatever that you're saying the right thing.
I was lucky. I had a good attorney, who was just a straight shooter. So he told me, expect 25 years. You're going to get 25 years.
Mm-hmm. Can I ask, when you heard that, do you remember what that felt like when you heard 25 years?
I remember I didn't care. You know, I just, I didn't have the ability to. Mm-hmm. I was really just devastated by the people. You know, I mean, there's no, what can you say? You know, I mean, these people lost their entire lives. That's 25 years, you know, and who cares? And I was suicidal anyway at that point. You know, I'd lost everything in my life. I'd been homeless on multiple occasions, and I just didn't care anymore, you know.
You're like,
and
this is what it's come down to. Just do
it. It was just defeat, you know. So I was finally, it was a big media event, as you can imagine. So they finally, the court, we had a court hearing, and many of the family members got to get up and sort of say their piece, and most of them were just genuinely amazing, very forgiving, compassionate people. And I think there was some sort of case made of, like, I wasn't a bad person, I was just a very sick person, which was nice and unusual in this case, because people...
Sure, that's normally they would just attack
it. Very unusual, and I will say real quick, Robert told me about this when I first met him, and I didn't immediately look it up. And I did a couple of weeks ago, and there are quite a bit of articles and interviews that were done, and that is the general gist, is that you're this really good guy that had a problem and something terrible happened because of it, which is unusual, because normally the press just, they take it and they run with it and they slam.
Were you able to listen to the family members? I mean, what was going on?
I mean, you couldn't not, you know. I mean, it was, I felt like I owed them anything, you know. Mm-hmm. So, you know, so most of them got up and sort of talked about, they wanted me to know about the people that were killed. They wanted me to know about their loved ones. And, you know, I sort of felt I owed them. I'm going to talk about that a little bit, because I've had an amazing week where it kind of came out of nowhere. But I had about an hour-long conversation with the mother of an 18-year-old kid who had been killed in that accident. And this is the first time we've talked. I was in prison early on, and we were riding each other, and we're sort of trying to feel our way through this and heal, and but there was no guidance, because it's prison, they don't do that, you know. And so it became a very sort of sick conversations. I mean, I think she was trying to forgive and didn't know how, and I was trying to do whatever she wanted to make things better, and I couldn't. And I celebrated 13 years of sobriety on November 1st, and so I had posted something on Facebook, and she managed to look me up and congratulated me.
Wow. You
know? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Wow.
So, I contacted her and just said, thanks for the support. And through that, we sort of ended up talking a little bit, and she said, look, I'd really love to tell you about my life. And, so we arranged to talk on, I think it was Wednesday or Thursday morning, and it was just great. You know, I mean, just healing for both of us. It's been a long time, and she was truly just generous and graceful and forgiving and powerful. You know, she was just great. you know, so part of what I wanted to talk about here today was prisons themselves.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah. Please do, because how much time did you get sentenced to?
I was finally given 8.5 to 11 years.
Okay.
And
okay.
So that's under structured sentencing guidelines. I didn't know anything about this, and I don't think people do, you know.
Sure.
And so it's not like the judge just gets to get and go like, this is it. So there's just different guidelines for how they sentence people based on what your crime is.
Mm-hmm.
And there's also different levels of custody, and we always think that, like, that's based on the crime. So if you've done something really heinous, you know, murder, rape sort of thing, and you don't get the death penalty. New York doesn't have a death penalty.
No.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Then you would go to, like, maximum custody. But it's also based on time. So I was sentenced to 8.5 to 11 years. So I was put in what they call closed custody, which is the mm-hmm. highest level. And that's sort of like the stuff you see on TV where you're like, they give us like a video on how to keep from getting raped.
Oh my God.
Wow. Yeah, I was actually thinking about this on the drive-in this morning, and the video included, like, stay away from the corner cells. Don't go near the corner cells, and that's going to be really important for you, which happens to be where all of the showers are and toilets in every prison I was ever at. So
You're like, thanks for nothing.
Yeah, and don't accept candy bars from people, you know, and that's sort of it, you know. So that was my introduction, and I think I'd been, I don't even know how long I was locked up, but I never had a problem with if people were gay or straight. Mm-hmm. It's just never been a thing of mine. So I got to prison, and people would sort of approach me, and I'd say, you know, it's not my thing. I'm really okay. I didn't understand that this wasn't, they weren't looking for, like, a relationship. This was it was a power thing. And
mm-hmm.
and eventually some guy was sort of really coming at me, and the guards came up to me one night to my room, and they said, look, this, I had just come back from a sober support meeting in the prison, and they said, look, we just got information this guy plans on getting you, and would you like to go to protective custody? And so that's a huge no-no in prison, right? You don't ask the police for anything, whatever. And so I said, and I had just been locked up, and so I was like, I've got a name to keep too. And so mm-hmm. I said, there's no way I'm going to do that. And so they said, well, you should know that the last guy he got ended up in the emergency room. He had been tied up in sheets all day. And, Yeah, so I said, great. Where do I put my stuff? You know, I'll be happy to sign any papers. So mm-hmm. protective custody in prison involved, I'm still angry about this. They took away my shoestrings. At the time, I smoked cigarettes. They took away my tobacco. They took away anything that I could use to harm myself with. They put me in handcuffs, and then they threw me into the hole.
For your protection?
Yeah, for my protection.
For your protection. Okay.
Yeah. So, and then they wouldn't let me out, you know. So you couldn't go out on the yard. They'd put you in a cage to go stand outside in the sunlight for an hour a day if you wanted to go outside.
Not that they would put the guy away in protective custody.
No.
The one that they know is going to come and get you. He was fine. Harmed other people. No. He gets to go about his normal business.
So I kicked and screamed for like a week, and they finally finally let me out, and because they were mad that I kicked and screamed enough to get out, they threw me back into the same block with the same guy, you know, and wouldn't lock my door behind me at night. So I would sleep at night with like a pencil, like waiting, like how am I going to hurt this guy I didn't want to kill anybody, but I wasn't going to have that happen. And finally, what happened was I sort of flipped out in the whole block. I'd sort of screaming crazily. And after that, they were like, oh, he's crazy. Stay away from him.
Yeah. That makes total sense. I've heard of that working before, and I've actually witnessed that working before. So.
And eventually what happened was they moved me to a medium custody level. And I had also sort of learned the customs and the norms in prison, and I knew how to get along, and people left me alone. And after that, things got easier. I read a lot of books. I practiced a lot of meditation through a book called We're All Doing Time, which is available free. If you've got somebody in prison, that you can give them that book for free. It's awesome. It's really taught me how to turn a prison experience into a monastic experience.
Okay.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
And that's mostly what I did for a long, long period of time.
Right. Just worked on healing and
getting better.
Bettering yourself.
Yeah.
Now, I did read, you know, obviously I said a lot of articles had been written, and they were very, very kind and understanding. But the people that comment and responded, they weren't so kind and understanding. Yeah. And I think that was one thing that somebody said was like, you know, you get to go to school and you get to do this and that.
Yeah.
But that obviously played some role in your rehabilitation, so to speak, would
Absolutely.
You say?
Yeah. It saved my whole mind. And I would have signed up for anything they offered. I would have taken, you know, basket weaving if they had that. I had to have something to do and to take my mind off. You can't spend every second of every day thinking about this event. It's not possible.
Right.
And I needed something to think of outside of myself. And I needed to think about something besides just being sober. And so they offered a horticulture class. It's not like, oh, you can go to prison and say, like, oh, I think I'm going to pursue a master's in whatever, you know. They offer things the prison needs. So they offer classes in horticulture, and they offer classes in the culinary arts, cooking.
Sure. Yeah.
And so I always think that's funny because I take, you know, most of us who are incarcerated are there for drugs and alcohol, and they teach people how to grow things and cook things.
Right.
You know?
Very well, too.
You know?
Real well.
I think that's important to note, though, because I think a lot of people, they just want someone to be thrown in a box, so to speak, or just you know, lock them away and throw away the key.
Yeah.
But people that in your situation, you know, you were struggling with alcoholism and this terrible thing happened, and you have full ownership and accountability of it, obviously. But it's good that people are given some things to help rehabilitate them so that when they come out, they can be a better person than they were when they went in.
They're going to be your neighbor, right? They're going to live next to you.
Right. You don't want to just throw them away and then have them come out and not know how to adjust.
People are going to come out, I think.
And I'm not talking like the you know, the serial killers here. No. I'm talking about...
It's interesting because you can take courses, correspondence courses. I took a few. But depending on your crime, some crimes, if you have a... I forget. I think it was a murder crime. You weren't allowed to take correspondence courses.
Right.
If you have a child sex crime, you're not allowed to take correspondence courses, you know?
Wow.
So it was. It's an interesting. I don't think what we're doing there is correct. I think we're truly like 100 years behind what needs to be happening. And you know, I also did a lot of reading about prisons. And so, you know, America started out as like other countries used to come and study us for what to do to create a compassionate prison system. You know,
Now it's opposite.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, we started out with the Quakers, and they started out with the compassionate prison system, which was instead of physically hurting people, we just incarcerate them, and we'd work on, at the time, you know, it was a religiously based a morality. People would be given a Bible and told to, you know, practice sort of a meditation contemplation thing. But what we're doing now is sort of, nobody really knows exactly what we're doing. You know, are we there to correct people, or are we there to punish people?
It's also who you hire, too. I mean, it's just like in the drug and alcohol field, a lot of people come in for a lot of different reasons, right? Many of them need a lot of their own healing. And obviously some corrections officers are coming in for power and, you know, to really do the good, to do the worst thing and not necessarily the best thing.
Or they mean well, and because of the environment, they sort of become,
fear-based. They're afraid of her.
Yeah, this is the Stanford experiment. One of the more interesting things that I was at a Eastern Correctional Center, which had a mental health wing on it. And so a lot of guys there were there for very severe mental illness. And, you know, one guy thought he was God and stabbed somebody 19 times.
Right.
You know, that sort of thing. Schizophrenia and bipolar, really severe bipolar disorder. And so they weren't allowed to sit with us in the chow hall, but they were, you know, sitting across from us. So I remember one of the guards told me, she was like, you know, I actually know what's wrong with these people. And so I was curious. I was having breakfast, and I said, what do you think that is? And she says, demonic possession.
Oh, yeah.
Really?
And
ding,
she,
ding, ding.
Well,
wow.
Yeah, yeah. And she's in charge of them. So that's a problem, you know.
It is a problem.
You know, so it's hard to get to, like, I mean, she's trying to be compassionate. She's working with the best information she has. But
there's a lack of knowledge there.
Yeah.
Now, at what point, because at some point while you were incarcerated, you decided that you wanted to be a drug and alcohol counselor, correct?
Yeah. I think I was spending a lot of time talking to people. I sort of also to save myself, I was like, I write a lot. And I sort of took on this idea of I was going to be a sociologist, and I would sit and write stories about the people I was meeting. And then I liked listening to people's stories.
Right.
You know? And so somewhere in there, I started thinking, I actually think I can do this. I think I can help people. You know, get better and try to help people not end up where I ended up, you know.
Now how, because that came to fruition.
Yeah.
Now how did you, I know that we don't have a lot of time and I definitely want to be able to have us go out with you playing the harmonica because this is really
cool,
dream
of mine.
And man, we really could have had you on a lot longer, but so can you like summarize, how did you become a counselor? Because that is what you are now.
So I got out, I'm married to an amazing woman now who I met while I was incarcerated. That's a much longer story.
I know. Maybe we'll have to have you back on.
Yeah, have so, both of you back on.
I got out and I had registered for school before I got out. So school had started a week before I got out, and we had contacted all these professors and said, like, oh, I'm moving. I was released to Charleston, South Carolina, and I'm in the process of moving, so I'm going to miss the first couple of classes. Is there anything I should know? And nobody wrote back. And so I went to my, you know, I think I'd been out 3-5 days when I went to my first class, and they said, congratulations, there's a quiz, you know. I'd been locked up for a long time, you know. So the next class I went to, they said, okay, well, so just submit your homework through D2L on Dropbox. And I went home to my wife and I burst into tears. I was like, what is a D2L? What's a Dropbox? Yeah, I just didn't know how to do anything.
Sure.
It was the best thing I could have done, because I had the schedule. I had to figure this stuff out. And you know, we ended up moving to Rochester. We're both madly in love with the city. It's a great place to be in recovery at. I went to Brockport for their drug and alcohol counseling program, and that's a phenomenal program. I was just nose to the grindstone the whole way. I was very, very driven and very determined. I ended up graduating. I didn't know what this meant, so I'm going to brag a little bit.
Yeah.
But summa cum laude, which like top of the...
Yeah.
Yeah. So my wife actually said, hey, you're summa cum laude. And when she wasn't looking, I Googled what... I had no idea what that meant. So, and I was hired, you know, if you're a male counselor, it's actually makes it a little easier. There's a shortage of us in the field, I think. So I was hired almost immediately.
And how long have you been doing that now?
Almost 2 years.
Okay.
Yeah, and I love... every day, you know? I mean, obviously I don't like the documentation, none of us do, but
no, that's right. A whole nother thing. And I'm thinking maybe we will schedule you to come back, so that people, because now people kind of heard like what happened and what you went through, and I think that you have a lot to offer.
Thanks,
in terms of what you do now. So I mean, if you're down with it, nothing like putting you on the spot while you're on the air.
No,
but
I'd
love to have you back, so
that
people can kind of have like a part two to the story to hear what life is like now.
I was a little bummed because I'm a big fan of your show and I've listened to all of them, and I thought, well, I'm not going to be the funny guy, you know. Like, I've heard people come on and be just great, you know, and my story is not that. So,
but it's so. Yeah. I mean, I've been sitting here. I had goosebumps. I had tears at one point, and I've just been staring at you. It sounds creepy for people who are listening, but I've just been like in awe of your story.
Thanks,
because. You know, there's a lot that people can learn from you, even me personally, because I am one of those people that was a not yet. I don't know how I never got a DWI. I don't know how I never hurt somebody, but I also lost my best friend to a drunk driver. I've experienced both ends of that whole being upset with somebody for taking someone's life because they were under the influence, and then being that person who very well could have done that themselves.
Yeah, and I always tell people, like, even with the mother I was talking about, one thing I said to her is we don't hate drunk drivers. We hate drunk drivers when they turn out to be bad at it.
Yeah.
You know, I go to a lot of live music and a lot of shows, and I watch a lot of cars leave, and the cops are down there directing them, you know, and they're not sober, you know.
Yeah.
But when they turn out to be bad at it, when they make the news, we're ready to jump on them, you know. And so we just need better solutions, you know.
Now, speaking of music, you've got a harmonica in front of
yes,
you.
Yes, because we are a music show.
Do you? How much time do we have left?
He could probably go out.
2 minutes?
You have 2 minutes?
I don't think I could play for
okay.
2 minutes.
Well,
just
give us something.
I want to play a riff so I can say I played my harp on live radio. So.
Did you get to play while you were incarcerated? Is that how
you actually, I played piano for the gospel choir band, which is about as romantic as it sounds, and I played harmonica there.
Wow.
Yeah. So.
Well, give us a little taste.
Go. That was great.
That's awesome. I just got a text message. Oh, he's good.
That was wonderful.
Thanks. I appreciate it.
Yay. Thank you so much for coming on today.
Yeah.
This has been a wonderful...
Yeah.
This has been a great experience for
no, thank
everyone.
We're
going to
have you
thanks
back, so stay
really
tuned. If you're listening, he will be back.
Right.
Thank you.
And everybody have a great holiday.
Yes.
I love you, Carrie.
Love you, too.
We'll see you later.
See ya.
Bye.
Smoke my stuff and drink.